Folks, today, there are a couple of things you may very well want to have on you. Up here on the left is the 25th chapter of Leviticus that we'll be looking at. Right next to it is a biblical commentary on Leviticus and how it does approach these things. And then here is an understanding of circumstances and systems of the Israel's year of Jubilee. And then yesterday we didn't finish some of the things about the keystone species. So I put more out there. These things we'll be doing actively. We'll be doing, in the last half, we'll be doing the wolves.
You hear that one?
And let's start now just to see if any thoughts or questions were on your mind overnight about where we started. So let's take any catch-up stuff for the first few minutes, and then we'll go on to the two pieces we'll have today. Any thoughts, questions, protests? Yeah.
So I think in here, or maybe, I don't know if you said it, but the idea of Jubilee was perhaps, I don't know if the word is codified or written in the priestly period, which would have been much later.
Mm-hmm.
So, but kind of looking back, I guess, so was there, back at the time when it was looking back, any notion of this at all? Or was it just in the imagination looking back?
That's a great question, Tim. I think I would just want to say three guesses that are mine, because that's an important thing. In other words, as part of what we were thinking about, was there really ever the Jubilee in effect? And I would say, first of all on that, I suspect that there are some portions of the Jubilee going on at several different parts of the children of Israel. In fact, tomorrow we're going to be looking at New Testament texts that clearly talk about it. And I think it's almost sure that the New Testament texts that talk about Jubilee don't know the Jubilee directly. But this Jubilee scholarship, they think there's a good chance that the Jubilee happens before there were ever monarchs or kings in Israel. That it was actually, as we know, there are probably for about 300 years of Israel that is just the tribes of Israel, and that didn't have monarchs. So they think that probably was the most likely time that there was actually the Jubilee, because The Jubilee, as we'll see today, focuses most on the countryside and not on the cities. So that's a guess of scholars. There's also a number of scholars that say after Israel is conquered by Babylon and Assyria and Greece and Egypt in the later periods, that they make the Jubilee as a kind of a thing they wish could happen, and they write a lot about it. So that that's the yours is a big picture question, and so I would want to say either at the very beginning or pretty late. And especially pretty late, it would be more nostalgic or wish that it could happen, because some other country is in charge of Israel then. Does that make any... that's what he answers.
I have a
question.
Yes, please. Yesterday, in talking about Jubilee, I know that Jubilee is an intention to give the land a rest, but I had the feeling and the understanding at certain points in the beginning of the pandemic that the reduction in industrial activity and the reduction in transportation really had kind of an effect on the earth,
mm-hmm.
that there wasn't so much pollution, there wasn't so much carbon emissions, that it had a chance to kind of rest a little bit.
Yeah, that's a lovely thought. I remember, this focuses on both of our points today. I remember early in the pandemic, there were, in our city, Philadelphia, there were animals that were coming into the city, mm-hmm. And walking around in various neighborhoods.
Like there was less traffic that discouraged them.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we'll be doing question and answer and riposte as we go along. I'm going to jump in now. This time, the first half will be more about the basic Jubilee. And I want to say I think I'd like us to just look at what I wrote up, understandings of circumstances and system of Israel's years of Jubilee in ancient Jubilee literature. Because this, what I tried to do is look at, see that I should say that there's a lot of Jubilee literature in the First Testament, but it's all over the place. So you'll find, for instance, that this morning we'll look at the 25th chapter of Leviticus, which is kind of weird in that the 24th and the 26th chapter has nothing to do with it, which actually probably shows that Leviticus, in other ways, it's fairly clear that Leviticus does not have story by and large. It often has more law in it than that, and it doesn't seem to be in order of, or in chronological order. Why they put the 25th chapter as Jubilee where it is hardly the case that we know. but anyway, when I look at this as a historical dimension, AC, I'm going to try to throw up this.
I can go down.
There, I think I can, no, okay.
Oh, help, help.
Yes!
Got it.
Yes, okay. The three most crucial are those.
AC, can I take your picture?
Of course.
Oh, yes, here. I want to include in our keeping in touch with each other that one of the most amazing things yesterday is AC has the class afterwards at 10:30, which I really has so much connection with what we're doing. But at the end of my session, and AC and class came in, I took his laptop and left mine here.
Oh, no.
Did not help AC.
It's okay, no worries.
So anyway, just to look a little bit at this one sheet, and this is the possible system that has almost entirely to do with agriculture. So almost all the texts in the First Testament are are about what you do on the land. That's very interesting because we know from very early on there are pretty amazing cities. And in a couple of texts it says, hey, if you think this applies to the cities, it doesn't. And we'll see a little bit of that in Leviticus this morning as well. This system would work mostly only in rural farming with towns, villages, and occasional lodgings beyond these towns and villages. But in the substantial periods of David, Solomon, Josiah, the Assyrians, the Babylons, and the Persians, it's almost impossible to think of most of Israel having a jubilee in effect, because there, for instance, Solomon is the text about Solomon have Solomon coming into the countryside and taking 5,000 slaves from his own people to go and build all the big buildings in the city. So that would probably not be a place where they would be, everybody would be focusing on what are we doing in the countryside. Then this asks the question, what is the kinship structure in the countryside? How does the countryside look in terms of how those who own the land or who have the land or work the land, how do they organize themselves? And here I want to just say two or three things. First of all, there's an Israelite kinship structure. This is the smallest structure on the farms, or on the land. And that has mostly to do with really small families of one or two, what we would call nuclear families. And they are, who's in charge there is the father of the household. Then there are clans. Clans, and this is in A1, A, B, and C. Clans are groups of fathers' households. And then three, there are tribes. Tribes are groups of clans. Now, in the texts, we have sometimes the fathers of the smallest place, they actually are running the show, and the texts say, do what your father says about the Jubilees. But also the clans are in many ways, which are groups of fathers' households. It looks like that's the most important in Israel, so that the clans sometimes can direct the father's households. The tribes are hit and miss in that. Sometimes the tribes, especially in times of crisis, the tribes will take over all three arenas. And we have texts where the tribes themselves are saying, hey, do this in the time of Jubilee. If that is confusing to you, that's what I mean to tell you, is that it looks like it's a rolling kind of social kinship structure. That is, to a certain extent, the father's households know that they belong to the clans and to a particular tribe. But often, the father himself will rule his own piece of property or piece of work on the land. Israelites' land tenure, the tribes determine the territory according to their clans in which heritage was given to the fatherly households. So that in A2 here, that sort of puts together those three levels of kinship. Now, Israelite land tenure determined the territory according to their clans in which heritage was given to the father's households. Fatherly households were not allowed to be bought or sold. So this is fascinating. In other words, in many ways, if there is ownership, and we talked yesterday about the fact that God, in some texts, is the owner of the land. But if people think of the land as their property, it's the smallest unit. It's the fathers who say, we really own. Other things in B down here, Israelites and Canaanites were not completely distinguished. And this is, and I'm talking about the, basically, the Jubilee. When you talk about Jubilee, it looks like, in many ways, there are some Canaanites and some Israelites who both think they are doing the Jubilee. Similarly, guests and residents overlap. In other words, you have people coming and going in the land of Israel. And this is the very early, probably not yet monarchical time. So guests and residents will intersect in those early periods and be talking about how they do these seven-year periods of Jubilee. Israelites were both enslaved and owners of enslaved in this period. So the biblical texts themselves, and we'll see a little bit of that today in Leviticus 25, basically there are Israelites that are enslaved by other Israelites. There are Israelites who enslave others that are not that are Canaanites, and some Israelites are enslaved by Canaanites. this, one of the things you can note about this is probably, again, before there is a king. In other words, the tribes, the clans, and the fathers are relating to Canaanites, often in a joint way in which they say, we own this together. That's what God says. Later, the kings will be much more powerful in trying to rule over the early non-king-like structures of tribes and clans. Aren't you glad that I put this together with all of this confusion and interesting overlap of how they fit together? There's a question, Tim.
Well, I mean, you ultimately also are talking about the species of this area. So it makes me think of the tribes of this area. And like in some of the earlier sessions, I don't know when it was, but they said, we're on the land of, and rattled off about five different tribes. And it sounds pretty similar in a way. Like the tribes of Israel were in this region, and here there was all these tribes that I assume didn't really own the land, but they probably kind of settled in a section and sort of was theirs, even if there's no like deed.
Mm-hmm.
And I assume that's kind of similar, and you know, it's a little fluid, but so anyway, it seems like there's a lot of comparison, but do you know, is there any like comparable notion of Jubilee with like Native Americans here or other places?
I was just going to say that. I think it's very clear in our country that humans had very similar intersecting ways of ruling together or of being together. So I certainly have talked with Native peoples here who intersect with clans and tribes.
Yeah.
So, I mean, one of my best friends is an elder in a clan and also knows that he belongs to a tribe and knows that he is the father of a certain set of people. Yeah, that's even now.
Yeah. So was there any Jubilee with all those Native people here?
Well, as usual, I'm ignorant where I shouldn't be.
Well, I flood stories seem to be kind of archetypal somehow for mm-hmm. cultures around the world. And I just wondered if Jubilee is also sort of that.
Well, I
might not know the answer.
Well, I don't know many of those answers, but when I go to in Oklahoma, when I go to my friend's clan for 3 days of celebration, there are intersected tribal belongings in the clan. So, in other words, yeah, I think it's really important for us to notice that the very early Israelites were in another kind of setting and another way of organizing the way they lived and worked together. It is not for them and was not for the tribes and clans and houses of Israel. It was not messy. It was simply overlapping in the way they lived their lives. So let's look a little bit at Leviticus 25. There are three pages here. Down at the bottom of the first page is the the very first section of this, and this actually sounds kind of like it's going to be in order, and then it's not. But look, if you would, at 25:2-7. Anybody interested in reading that out loud for us all?
I don't know where 2 starts, so I'm just going to start at the beginning here. Yahweh spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai. He said, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you enter the land that I'm giving you, the land is to keep a Sabbath rest for Yahweh. For 6 years you shall sow your field. For 6 years you shall prune your vine and gather its produce. But in the seventh year the land is to have its rest, a Sabbath for Yahweh. You must not sow your field or prune your vine, or harvest your ungathered corn or gather grapes from your untrimmed vine. This is to be a year of rest for the land. The Sabbath of the land will itself feed you and your servants, men and women, your hired labor, your guests, and all who live with you. For your cattle, too, the animals on your land, all its produce will serve as food."
So this is really what we said yesterday, the picture of what we looked at. And then you'll see right after that, in 8-12, it goes on with this sevens thing. It says, okay, after the seven years, then that's the Jubilee. And then that's when it really makes sense to go deeply into ways that, and I'll just say this out loud, one of the things that happens over 7 times 7 years is lives get messed up. Slaves are made. Families fall apart. And one of the main things that's done in the 50th year is stop, let the land, again for a seventh time, rest, and then take time to make sure that you are doing right by one another. So that's when, for instance, if not before, because sometimes you see enslaved people being freed way before, but if a person has been enslaved for 5, 10, 20 years and has not been and is still enslaved, in the 50th year, according to this system, everybody gets to go free. Similarly, what is laid out in this next section of Leviticus is, if people have debts, if the debts have been going on way longer to one another than they did, in the 50th year, everybody has to basically no longer be in debt or no longer have money that isn't theirs. So that's what is a long period of time to make sure that these injustices don't go on too long. One might want to say that is too long. But it's a very interesting way of thinking about justice inside of what I would say is probably a non-city government. So in the countryside, it's a way of making sure, or wanting to make sure, that enslavement and indebtedness doesn't go on too long. Too long in question mark. Tomorrow I'm going to be looking at the way in which the New Testament, under Roman imperial rule, in the name of Jesus and Jesus' people, reopen this possibility. So we'll see very clearly in the book of Luke, which is probably the latest gospel, they are starting to say, hey, look at the way they wrote up how we should be as a people in times of slavery and indebtedness and all kinds of other freedom. Let me see if there are any more thoughts or questions. I commend to you then both all of chapter 25 and then this page which says Jubilee Zero. That's five or six pages that goes through Leviticus 25 and goes. Yes, please.
I have two thoughts. The other person asked about whether or not the local tribes had some sort of thing of Jubilee.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I'm understanding, it applied more in an agricultural economy, which I don't think they had here, but it was primarily hunter-gatherer economy, so it might not apply as much.
Yeah, that's a great question. And especially in the tribes and clans that I look at, there is an ability to move around to do things together. And that has probably to do with the fact that the peoples of our land, of their land, really were moving a lot more than that the people of Israel, probably when it was most doing the Jubilee, it was also least organized as a monarchical society. But that meant that it could actually do something similar. So I would say there, actually tribes and clans both are flexible in the way they think about how they work together and how they and who's in charge in what in what categories. And I think you said the second?
Oh, the second point was just, I remember as we approached the year 2000, the big movement for Jubilee to forgive some of the poorer nations their debts.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was partially successful, but I don't remember the details, but I just remember that as we approached.
Yeah, that's really true throughout the text, that there's a, what we would say, a uneven way of being together, but often really together, in owning and in working together. Yes?
What's the reasoning or justification for this conclusion that the system wouldn't work with an imperial ruler, or it only works agriculturally, I suppose, rather than in a more authoritarian or modern type society?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's mainly the way kings and empires, imperial people, have massive violence to keep them in control, and the cities have a lot of financial power. So one of the big things about Israel is Israel keeps running into the fact that the rich people in the city give loans to the countryside, and often will take over the land of the people in the countryside because they didn't pay back their loan. So in other words, it's kind of like, almost one might say, the banks of the city and the really the military of the city are very strong powers.
So the statement's more as in similar to our society, I suppose, that the elites and the rulers won't let it happen, not so much that it can't happen.
Yeah,
I guess those are intertwined together in the power structures, but it's not so much that the societal structure won't allow it to happen, so much that there's power concentrated too acutely for them to let something like that happen and challenge their power.
Yeah, no, I think that's where I'm going. And for instance, the First Testament prophet Amos just lays into the people in the city for doing exactly that. And many prophets just take on both David and Solomon for making a city that ruled over the countryside.
So even in the time of like David and Solomon, when they were like God's kings or whatever, there was still that type of indebtedness of the agricultural people in Israel society?
Yes. Judges, meaning the Book of Judges, the Book of Kings, the Book of Chronicles, all give the numbers of the thousands of slaves that Solomon had to build his big buildings in the city.
Well, so even in Judges, because that was, you know, theoretically one of the more almost socialist type of structures that the Israelites went through.
Yeah.
There wasn't any rulers or elites, technically. I mean, they were still doing the same type of indebtedness.
Well, Judges is got a long period. One of it has cities included and one of it doesn't.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, yes, go ahead.
In this one handout on understanding the circumstances, you talk about the instability of the Israelite agricultural economy and erratic farm production. But to support those cities, you need a certain stability, don't you? Because you need the farm economy producing enough surplus to support the elites in the cities, the armies, the slaves that may be working on the temples or whatever.
Oh, sure. I mean, it feels to me like in general, the cities of the Near East take over in order to organize more complex systems of government and power. And it looks like in much of the way one reads the First Testament, it looks like that by and large the prophets are really trying to hold on to the land and the people in the countryside as being who God loves most. Over and over again you have that kind of anti-city approach to what God wants. Well, I want to move on to the other part of art, more postmodern thinking, and that is to look at what we looked at yesterday, and that was mainly the keystone species. But I'm going to move today away from otters and up into the Cascade Mountains, and start looking at these five species that I outlined yesterday and to how that has an amazing, I think, importance for the way humans might think about who we can be in the bigger picture of the Earth. And so I'm going to go to wolves first, and I'm going to just lay this out, and you can look at this as well if you want, but you don't have to look up on the screen. But I over the last several months, I've been trying to get a picture of these five species. And as I said yesterday, there are what has happened in, here in Washington is that nobody has been actually wanting wolves, but wolves continue to come in at an increasing amount into not only the Cascades, but to the eastern part of the state. And I'm going to just lay out what those wolves, what happens when wolves come into a part of the state. And I want to say clearly that this seems to me to be something that is not on our radar, but might be on the divine radar. So one of the things we can say about gray wolves is they mostly are predators of medium and large hoofed mammals, moose, elk, white-tailed deer, mule deer, caribou, muskox, and bison. Gray wolves, of course, not the bison anymore, probably, have long legs that are well adapted to running, allowing them to move fast and travel far in search of food, large skulls and jaws that are well suited to catching and feeding on large mammals. Now, you might want to say, well, what's good about that? And this is going to unfold, I think, pretty quickly. Why is the gray wolf a key species? Wolves are critical keystone species in a healthy ecosystem. By regulating prey population, wolves enable many other species of plants and animals to flourish. This is just totally counter thought for me, but in these last several months, I'm buying in. They are known as keystone predators because they help maintain a balanced ecosystem. Because gray wolves eliminate only the weak animals, herds become stronger and healthier as a whole. Gray wolves are a top predator whose presence has a ripple effect on the rest of the ecosystem. Studies show that wolves keep elk populations in check, preventing them from overbrowsing on willow and aspen, which in turn helps maintain healthy standards of trees in the landscape. Wolves are a boon to other predator populations as well. With wolves' uneaten food scraps strengthening the food supply of scavengers like eagles, coyotes, and bears. I just never even imagined things like this. Here's a study that looked at wolves when there were no wolves in Wyoming, where the national park was, and then what happened afterwards when there was more, when the wolves were allowed to come back in to the national parks. Elk, when there were no wolves, no longer pressured by predator wolves, they became abundant and began to damage their own environment. Elk populations were so out of control that park rangers began to kill and relocate elk in large numbers in an attempt to reduce the burgeoning population. The aspens seldom reached full height in the Yellowstone northern valleys where elk winter. So, in other words, there were no people, no animals that were keeping the elk under control, and the elk were starting to do damage to all kinds of other things in the northern part of Wyoming. Coyotes, no longer having to share the land with wolves, became much more abundant and one of the park's top predators. But the coyotes' small size kept them from regulating the park's large populations of big mammals like wolves do. Though coyotes will kill elk calves, they prey mainly on pocket gophers, voles, and other small mammals. When you got wolves back into Yellowstone, it's an amazing thing that happened. I'll go through just some of this, and it's on the screen too. Elk, the primary prey of wolves in Yellowstone, have decreased in numbers within the park. Other factors such as drought, severe winters, and other large predators have also contributed to the decline in Yellowstone elk. But as wolves returned, the behavior of elk changed. Elk became more vigilant and were once again forced to stay on the move. Vulnerable along the rivers and streams, elk now spend more time in denser cover or on higher ground with better vistas for spotting predators. Consumption of vegetation by elk is thus restrained, giving many basically water areas a chance to recover. Now, I want to say what happened in Yellowstone with wolves is they made the elk better elk. In other words, the elk started working much more with all the things going on rather than taking over. And as many of you may know, I've been to, you all have all probably been to Yellowstone also a lot, and there are plenty of elk, just not too many. The aspens are now growing and the willows are growing because the elk aren't making or damaging all of these trees. Coyote numbers are dropped because the wolves are starting to kill them. And that means that the coyotes don't have an overpopulation and leave a lot of other small animals to interact more thoroughly with a lot of the different kinds of populations. Wolves cull the sick, old, and genetically inferior elk and deer, allowing the healthiest individuals to breed and perpetuate their species. Wolves feed other animals, the remains of their carcasses left behind. Wolves improve the water areas. Wolves have redistributed the elk herds, allowing vegetation to recover along the rivers and streams. Wolves decrease coyote populations. I like this last one that I found. Wolves boost ecotourism. This says adding 35 million to the local economy annually. Weird, interesting things that have. So we now have this real interesting study of what happens when wolves come into an area that has lots of different plant and animal dimensions to it. So here, I've also studied this summer the fact, as I said, that wolves are actually coming back into Washington across, basically from about 40 miles east of Seattle on through to the eastern edge. So that includes a lot of the Cascades. Yes,
yeah, Mary. I remember voting for a issue, I'm thinking it was 20 years ago, maybe it wasn't that long ago, and it was all about restricting hunters' ability to kill wolves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting to hear this talk to see what the result of that was, because I remember voting for, yeah, protect the wolves, and then hearing stories about little kids being attacked by wolves, and thinking, mm-hmm. oh, I voted mm-hmm. wrong, but I was like, okay, maybe I voted right.
Well, my understanding is that you lost in that election.
I thought it went.
Maybe.
Well, so what we've got is a situation in Washington where the large, you haven't mentioned it yet, but the large mammals that are the mammal of concern, especially in the northeastern corner of the state, are cattle.
Yep.
And that's where the conflict lies. Mm-hmm. And it was just this year that yet again a wolf culling was allowed to go forth of one particular
right.
pack
right.
that had been habituated, they said, towards attacking calves. And that, of course, attacks the livelihood of the ranchers.
Right.
So, like the last line up there, the wolves boost ecotourism. Boy, there's the clash right there.
Yeah.
35 million to the economy, but not into the financial support of the people who are living off of the land by raising cattle.
Yeah.
So, and then I thought that, I don't recall past or not past, but I do know that this went on and that there were more wolves that were killed this year.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do remember that. There was too many wolves, and they had to have periodic
wolves. Yeah. And this, I don't think this is an easy or uncomplicated thing to think through.
Yeah.
But to see the way that the wolves help the social structures and the of both plants and other animals is a very interesting dimension. I, by the way, was raised a rancher, and I know how to hate wolves really well until I read some more about it. And I know that I, as a rancher, I wasn't even interested in what the big picture was. I just was interested in us making money. And that is, I mean, and then actually I went broke as a rancher, or my parents did. And they didn't say that it was the wolf's fault, but at any rate. So here, it seems to me that it's a really interesting question for us about the Cascades. In other words, it seems like there's a possibility that more wolves in the Cascades would make the Cascades a fuller part of the earth, because it would have the same focus on it. And at least in the Cascades, there are not as many ranchers. There are some, I'm assuming. But what do you all think about this, and we'll make this fuller in the next several days, because we'll look at four other species.
I feel like that's kind of a nice segue into the whole global warming issue. Because if you think about global ecosystems, it's a direct conflict with individual economic gain. And that's, you know, unless we figure out that out, it's just always going to be this struggle, and we'll see who wins. And mm-hmm. I'm not that hopeful that's
going to
be the
imperial
system.
Yeah, but say a little bit more about that.
Well, I just figure it's probably going to be the economical gains that will be the side that wins, because I don't think you're going to fix the ecosystem worldwide and be able to manage global warming, if that's a global warming, without changing your mentality to support all people and all beings and not worry about the economic gain.
The short-term economic gain is going to win.
Correct.
You'll have to be more specific when you say that.
Yep.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and then the other thing I think that's important in the minds of democratic or somewhat democratic state, meaning that votes on different things, are the either thoughts or facts about wolves killing kids. I would assume, and I haven't done this real thoroughly, I would assume that by and large that's myth. But I would assume that it happens sometimes.
We've had some issues. Effective fear monger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've had some issues with cougar in the Cascades.
Right.
And, not kids.
Yeah,
yeah.
Adults.
Adults, yeah. Attacks.
Yeah. Bicycles, yeah.
Right.
I just want to mention an organization that works on, among other things, that works on the wolf populations in this state, and that's Conservation Northwest. And we've kind of kept up on the issue through what they've shared through their emails and stuff. But they've done a lot of work trying to help the ranchers, you know, accept a certain amount of loss and not kill all the wolves.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really a kind of a three-way thing with the State Department of Fish and Wildlife, because they're the ones that come in and call the wolves. And they have a certain plan that they're not going to do it unless a certain amount get killed. Anyway, Conservation Northwest is one organization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's really important that, I'm very interested in Holden itself thinking through this. It seems to me that that's very close, not only to socio-political things that we, that this place does, but also spiritually. It's a very important way for me to think about the character of the divine, I am a little bit better influenced informed on Wyoming and Montana, in that when environmentalism first came, there were laws in both Wyoming and Montana, as I understand it, that whenever a bear or a wolf would kill cattle, the government would pay for that. That has now changed in both of those places, as I understand it, because the rancher population has said they don't want any, they just simply want the wolves to be culled in dramatic ways. It's an interesting dimension to how we think about this. By the way, I do have my mic for upstairs, AC, and I know that you have some really wonderful and interesting leadership in things like this. So just, I'll give you this if you want to say something, if you would. So what would it be like, for instance, for us at Holden to, and again, the wolf is the hardest question. It's a little bit different than beaver. And it may be that, well, it seems like, we'll talk about beaver tomorrow. But my studies are that beavers are amazingly productive in terms of all different kinds of life growing bigger, both animals and plants. But we'll talk about that tomorrow. It's a little bit more fierce a question for us to talk about wolves. I find myself as somebody that's, you know, this is my 13th teaching session over the last 7 years here. It feels like that this would be a place where we wouldn't be necessarily angry at each other for talking about a complex and interesting earth question up here. Yes.
So it's along that line, which is a good thought. I mean, I'm imagining a family walking down the trail to Heart Lake and it's like, yeah, beaver, yeah, coyotes, rattlesnakes, oh yeah, wolves, cougar. So then I immediately thought, okay, what's it like in Alaska? Because this is their native turf and they've never left.
Mm-hmm.
And I've run into people that carry a big 357 Magnum with them to deal with a bear. Mm-hmm. Or to deal with wolves.
Right.
And these are people that are not gun culture, so to speak, people. Rather, they're just concerned for their own safety and rightly so.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, it might change Holden's ecosystem in the sense you can't just wander down the trail happily, but rather have bear belts, like you do if you hike in Alaska,
mm-hmm.
or bear spray, or but wolves, how do you?
That's really lovely as an idea, I think. And the other thing that might happen is that we humans might not say we have a right to go everywhere in the Cascades all the time. In other words, what would it be like if we had limits to the way we were in the Cascades? I'm also a mountain person, so I'd have a hard set of things to think through. But it seems to me that this vast amount of territory that could be taken care of by wolves in amazing ways does call for us to think through more complexly who we are and what our relationship is. A bear belts among them.
Yeah.
So, and I'm wanting our conversation to be clear. Yeah. See you later, AC.
I'll be right back.
Okay, thanks. Yes.
Well, as I'm listening, I'm just thinking of that premise of survival of the fittest.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it sounds like for the ecosystems to be balanced in the way they, it seems like you're going back to the original ecosystem because there is survival of the fittest in both ways, you know, whether it's healthy or not healthy, which it sounds like this ecosystem with these keystone species, they're promoting an idea of a healthy ecosystem.
Yeah.
So anyways, it's just that kind of thing running through the conversation and wondering about it, not knowing exactly what to do.
Yeah, exactly. I wanted to point out that one of the things we didn't do yesterday in this larger piece on the Keystone Species, one of the things that they did is they talked about what kind of thing happens in Keystone Species. And there were three kinds of animals that were the Keystone. One was predators, and one might say the good predators of wolves and otters. Second, it turns out that there are what is called ecosystem engineers. I mean, these are, we're talking about animals. And grab this if you want. The beaver is an ecosystem engineer and does amazing things relative to not being a predator, but doing all kinds of basic keystone behavior. And finally, there are mutualists, which are accidental kinds of species that bump into each other in territory and decide to work together. So, in other words, it looks like it's not just a matter of good prey on one another, but it's we're just beginning to think about what this system is in across the spectrum of species. I think I'm out of time. I'm almost strict on time. Oh, yeah, way over. Excuse me. Beavers tomorrow. Beavers tomorrow and more Jubilee. Yeah, Jubilee in the New Testament tomorrow.